everybody. I'm Karen Hart Glass. You're listening to It's All About Food. This is a great day. I am talking with Seth Tibbett. Do you know who Seth Tibbett is? Of course you do. Tofurky's founder, chairman, and CEO of the 35 years. And we're going to learn a lot more about him and his wonderful new book, In Search of the Wild Tofurky, How a Business Misfit Pioneered Plant-Based Foods Before They Were Cool. That says it all. I want to say welcome. Thank you for joining me. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I want to make one small correction.
Yes.
The CEO title now is my stepson, Jamie. I mean, I'm founder, chairman, but I got to give credit and props to this amazing guy who has just taken the dream of Tofurky places I could never imagine and done such great things. So props to Jamie, but great to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, you mentioned that he became CEO in the book, along with a lot of other wonderful stories.
Yeah, I fired myself in 2014 from president job. That's my MO, is a long trail of firing not others, but me.
Firing yourself from all the jobs you're doing. So yeah. Not only is this like a memoir, but you write it as you write it for an audience of potential people starting in a business, the
right.
Bootstrappers.
Right.
But it's really a book for everyone, whether you're interested in starting a company or not.
Yeah, it's a good story, but you know, you're right. I'm just so amazed to see how far we've come and where we're at right now. And it's so great to see all these little companies springing up all over the world. It's not just a US or North American phenomenon. You know, this is happening worldwide in Indonesia and India and all over Europe. So it's great to see these startups. And ironically, there's a lot of small little tempeh startups, which I love too. Local little tempeh people doing just the same thing that I did to start. So I love to see the position that we're in now and the adoption of plant-based diets worldwide.
It is exciting to have the variety of products out there. And I've been a vegan for 32 years, and your story,
wow.
I felt like, yeah, I was there. I remember that. And I remember that. So I love reading that journey.
Yeah.
Because it brings back memories for me too. But I also loved your story and your mission the whole time. And before we get into the book, which I really want to do, and I have a whole bunch of questions, what I loved when I finished the book, I felt good. I felt happy. It was just
good.
The whole story and your own personal ethic was something that I really enjoyed reading about. And I had read another book just before yours, and I don't want to trash it or anything, but it was a well-written book, but it was about cultured meat. And it just left me with a very different feeling. The feeling behind it was capitalism rules, and money matters, and the people in power are the ones that are going to get what they want done. And that was not an inspiring feeling. Your book was very different that way. It was a good ethic and hard work. And I think that's what's important.
Yeah, well, I'd agree. You know, there's so many different little nuances within the plant-based movement, but I feel like we're all pushing for the same goal. And that's what's cool about it, is that baked into the DNA of every vegan business, and this goes from the small little tempeh bootstrapper at their local farmer's market, all the way up to Pat Brown and Ethan Brown running these big publicly held companies. They've got, that's our superpower. We all have a sense of mission that this is important to bring to the world. And, you know, whether it's you know, it speaks to different people in different ways. So viva la difference, and viva all of the entrepreneurs. I call them plantrepreneurs that are out there putting it all on the line and starting these great businesses the world so desperately needs. So we want all vegan businesses to succeed. It's such a big job in front of us, veganizing the world. It's way bigger than one brand. So
yeah, well, I don't think the businesses today could have gotten started without a business like yours as a front runner.
Well, thank you. And that's nice of you to say. And it was really, it's been the joy of my life, one of the big joys of my life, that to be just a part of this movement and to have a front row seat to see it grow from nothing, because that's where it was. The market for plant-based foods in the U.S. supermarkets in 1980 was exactly $0.00. I mean, there was accidentally vegan products, sure, like Oreo cookies and stuff like that, but there wasn't a market, you know, or anything for these products. And then to see now, you know, I just bought Tofurky bought, I should say, the latest AC Nielsen look at the refrigerated meat alternative category. And as of 12 weeks, like the first quarter of this year that ended March 22nd and for AC Nielsen, the category was up 128%. And that's like, amazing. And it's amazing when you look at, because supermarkets, if they grow 2%, like all food and supermarkets, if they get 2% growth, they're like happy. So for a while, this category was growing at 5%, and the supermarkets were, wow, we got to get more of this in. This is more than twice the growth of all food. So they were making space. Now they just, you know, are stumbling over themselves to do it. And for us manufacturers, it's just not where are we going to sell these products, it's how are we going to keep up. You know, so it's an amazing,
it's a great time. Space to be in. Yep.
Yes, it is.
I used to run these festivals in New York and in the early 2000, and it was very hard to get suppliers, vendors of products to exhibit at the event. And then like 10 years later, it's completely changed.
Oh yeah.
There's just so many people available that want to show their wares, and the magazines that have the advertising now, because there are so many companies that want to promote themselves for plant-based foods, which is wonderful. Okay. You have a very self-deprecating tone in the book and some very nice humor. I like how you talk about entrepreneurs being misfits. That's in your title. Why is that important?
Well, who better than a misfit to, you know, think outside the box and to really be successful as an entrepreneur. I think it really helps to have an idea that a lot of people think is crazy. You know, like my Aunt Rosie, I think you saw in the book too,
yes,
told me right off straight. She was a woman that spoke her mind, you know, and God bless her for doing that. And she told me, hey, this is a terrible idea. Again, Tofurky, there was a lot of people just discounting that and laughing at it and saying, you're crazy to have such a funny name. But I think the misfit, you know, is trying to solve a problem that maybe they have. But I think that it uniquely qualifies you for entrepreneurship. It should be a prerequisite for any entrepreneur, is this feeling like, I see a challenge here. This is not being met, and I see a way out, and I have this great idea. So
to do it better.
Yeah, to do it better. You know, you feel like you're a misfit because you are positioned to make a better world. I mean, that's why you feel like your needs aren't being met. And
well, there are many misfits. There are many misfits out there. So the message to all the misfits is, you're a misfit for a reason.
And you're come here up with, to build a better world.
That's right. Come up with your passion and follow it. You laid it out in the book where you were looking for something and something became apparent, like a location, and it turned out to be the right thing at the right time. I don't know where you are spiritually, but do you feel that the universe has guided you in certain ways?
I do feel like there have been some hints from a benevolent universe that I have been able to log into at certain key times. But a lot of that comes from just hard work too, and, you know, finding your passion and following your passion. And that's one of the clues the universe gives you. When you start a business, things just start happening for you. And if they're not happening for you, then maybe you need to do a reboot and look at some other way of doing it. You know, some of the most success, we were a pivot from Tempe to Tofurky that really changed it, you know, because Tempe, which was doing great, but not great enough to support, you know, my dream and the people that were making the Tempe, you know, we were just a cottage industry and we couldn't pay insurance and all of the things that you should have as a worker, you know. So pivoting was a big thing. You know, Starbucks used to be a company that sold machines, that coffee machines. That was their whole thing. And then Howard Schultz went to Italy and saw all these fabulous, you know, cafes and said, oh, this is a concept, bigger thing. So, you know, YouTube used to be a dating site, I think.
I didn't know these things until I read your book.
Yeah. So anyways, pivots are really important, and changing, because, and the universe will point out, like, when you've done a good job with your pivot and your vision, and it, things start happening, magic things start happening. That's how you know you're on the right track.
I have a question about making tempeh, and you're the tempeh making expert, right?
Okay, shoot.
So I do a lot of cooking. My partner and I do a lot of cooking. Just recently, I made tofu for the first time. I can't believe I never made it, but I've made it a bunch of times. I make my own soy milk, and anyway, it's kind of fun. Here we are, sheltering in place, and you realize I got to figure this out, because what happens if? And we haven't been going to stores, so we don't make tempeh. And I've read about making tempeh, but my question is the spores.
Yeah.
Do you have to keep getting them? Can you replenish them like when you're making yogurt? How does that work?
Technically, you can do that, but I do not recommend it. I recommend starting from a fresh batch, just because you can get contamination in the spores the longer you keep it going. So I always start when I make tempeh, and I still make tempeh at home. Never made tofu, by the way. So you're one up on me there. But okay, tempeh is great to make at home. It's so fun and it's so magical. You know, you cook these beans, you dehull the beans, and you dry them, and then you add the spores. You put them in your oven. You can put them in the oven with the oven light on and just the door cracked a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you want to keep them at around 88 degrees for 24 hours. You come down the next morning, it's like Christmas. You open the door and here's this fragrant, mushroomy smelling tempeh. And the tempeh you make at home, I guarantee you, will be X factor better than anything you will find in the store. Like, tempeh is one of those products that is so much better fresh. Tofurky is one of the magic things about tofurky, is tastes the same day zero or 150. It's great. But tempeh, this microorganism growing thing, it's mind-blowing fresh. So I'll send you the I have a whole tempeh making instruction thing about how to do it, and where to get the spores.
That's
and everything
great.
And I really recommend people doing that. I teach classes in that from time to time. I love turning people on to making homemade tempeh because it's so fun. And then you're right, sheltering in place. What better thing to do than make your own protein for like 50 cents a pound?
Have you done any video how to make tempeh programs, or just in person?
Yeah, I've just done it in person. Person to person, but that would be a good idea.
Yeah, it's time, Seth.
Okay, it's I'm time. On it. I'm on okay. it. Because I've seen some videos online and some I don't agree with some of the points about them. So I'll do that for you.
Well, thank you. I'm jumping ahead because I just had an idea. But I understand that you've helped support Miyoko with her business early on.
Yeah.
And she was kind of a Tofurky quasi-competitor for a short time with her un-Turkey. But she's done a lot of videos and a lot of FaceTime stuff where she's making a lot of
I love it.
Yeah. A lot of products that are in her recipes, her recipe books. I'm pointing to the back shelf here where I have like 1,000 vegan cookbooks and hers are in nice. Here. But also some of the products that she makes. She gives you the recipes on how to make them and show you how to do them. So it's time for you.
I love Miyoko and I love what she's done with her cheese. And, you know, it was like at one of the Expo Wests in 2014 or something, we had a big party. You know, we did the Tofurky after party after the show, and Miyoko came and she brought this plate of amazing cheeses that she had. And, you know, we were talking about, well, should we go in business together and do this or should I do it on my own? And Ethan Brown was there and he came up to me and he was just getting his business going, you know, and he goes, do you mind if I talk to Miyoko? Are you working with Miyoko? Little known fact. Like, can you imagine if they had teamed up? But, you know, really, I think it turned out the best for her because, again, if she had done it through Tofurky or Beyond Meat or whatever, it wouldn't have the ownership and the pizzazz and the passion that she has now and just the accolades that she's finally getting that have been, you know, so well deserved. So I'm thrilled that she has taken off. And yeah, I gave her some money to start out, you know, right when she was getting going and helped her, but she's in the stratosphere now. She's
out there tough. Doing it. And so I love what she, well, I don't, she's amazing, but let's get back to you. You're also amazing. I like the idea, like Miyoko and like yourself, you've kept control of your companies. And this is a really an important concept. There are plenty of other vegan products out there. And I know that when they were bought out by other companies, that gave them more shelf space in supermarkets and enabled more people to get access. But there's something different when a major food supplier or maker takes over your product.
True. And from a consumer standpoint, I feel that too when a company sells. But, you know, Tofurky grew, the Tofurky model of growth has been step by step, row by row, I'm going to make this garden grow. You know, it's just been like, in reinvesting the profits and growing at a time when the space itself was growing at a sustainable kind of 5-10% a year level. And that was what we did. You know, when we would make 15% or 20%, that would be like huge year. So we were averaging growth of that. So we managed the growth like that. That said, right now, it's a very different world. In 1980, we weren't thinking like, oh my God, in 40 years, is the earth going to be habitable? And, you know, what are there's so many pressures now to really, we got to get this. It's almost like, well, it is like I believe the future of the planet is at stake here. So we've got to get big and smart and fast. So I do not, you know, look down upon people that have taken any kind of money or, you know, been an equity play where they've sold some equity. And we're actually having the conversations now that I never thought we'd have just because, you know, we're the space is so different right now. And we're going up against, you know, companies that have, I think, 120 R&D people at Impossible Foods. You know, there's $50 million in social media, you know, budgets, like crazy money right now. So it'll be interesting to see where we end up. But, you know, it's been a great model and it's really served us well, I think, because you're absolutely right. And that's why we haven't sold thus far, is that there is this feeling about companies that are independent and that have passion. You know, Follow Your Heart's another independent company that I love and has so much passion for things that is lost. And I've seen so many companies sell and it not go well for either the buyer or the seller, and there's regret on both sides. So it's
well, as the consumer,
it's a different world now.
As a consumer, we have more trust in the companies that don't sell out.
Yeah.
And I did air quotes there for people that are just listening.
I saw them.
Yeah. And so that's what's important about your company. And I want to talk about the tofurkey products that you make, because I'm a whole food plant-based kind of person. I like to keep things simple. I eat beans and rice and minimally processed foods.
Yeah,
but for a processed manufactured food, it is pretty clean.
Yeah. You know,
and what, how did you come to that decision? Or maybe the isolated products weren't available, or what happened?
They were available. You know, we saw early on, like, there's this difference. There's the traditional soy proteins like tofu, tempeh, miso, shoyu, and then there's the what we call the industrial proteins, which are the TVP, which are the isolated soy proteins and everything. And there, it's a whole different process between the two. These proteins like tofu and tempeh, they've had a long history in the world of supporting health and supporting good nutrition in the people that have been eating them. You know, there's nothing new. I mean, tofu is, they're both centuries old. And so the industrial proteins are really a factor of the extraction of soy oil. And they use this hexane ingredient, which is an ecotoxin. It's an ingredient in gasoline, by the way. And it separates the protein from the starch. And it, when they do that process, the hexane, they soak the beans in this vat of hexane. And then when they take the beans out, it evaporates off, but it goes into the atmosphere. It's a crazy process. And it isn't really as much of an environmental plus that the traditional ones are. And it is very similar in its footprint, from what I've read, to meat, actually. You know, it's just such an intense thing. So you're not doing that. So even though there's parts per million in the product after it's all gone through this cleansing and powdered, what part do you want in your, you know, food of gasoline?
Zero. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Correct answer. Ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
Give the gal $100. The duck comes down.
I have a master's in chemical engineering. Hexane is not something I want in my food.
Yeah. But, you know, it is, that being said, I still will eat like some, you know, the Gardein. I love a lot of their products.
Sure.
And, you know, so it isn't black and white with me, but that was my whole feeling, was just basing things on as natural and traditional. And people don't do the nuance too well. A lot of times they just like lump us in there and say, oh, you know, tofurkey's like processed with hexane. And we're like, no. Or people think, I've even read articles that people say, oh, tofu is a hexane process, and it's not.
Oh,
and,
gosh. You got to make tofu yourself and find out. It's just beans.
I know. You didn't have a little vial of hexane that you threw in that tofu you made, did you?
I did not.
Okay, I believe you.
I did not.
But it's, yeah, I'm a big fan. I'm still like tempeh mad, you know, because I just think that's such a nutritious and
healthy
product.
We love tempeh. I've tried many of the industrial plant meats just because I'm always excited with new products and I want vegan products to take over the world. And I'm so thrilled that they're all out there. But at home, I tend to just keep it as simple as I can. I want to say that when I was a kid, I was a meat eater. I became vegetarian.
Me too.
Most of us were. But I became a vegetarian at about, I started on my veg path at 15. But before then, I liked turkey. And when we would go out for family dinners, I always ordered the turkey, which was sliced turkey with a brown gravy on a pile of mashed potatoes.
Yeah.
That was my thing. And then when turkey was off the table, finally, when the tofurkey deli slice came out, that was my thing for Thanksgiving. I wasn't into the roast. I wanted that feeling that I had at the restaurants where, and I like to make my own gravy and my own mashed potatoes and my own cranberry sauce. So then I would kind of rip up the slices and put them over the mashed potatoes and the gravy. And it was wonderful. So I want to thank you for that.
Yeah, no, that I've done the very same thing. And I think that they're a good replacement. And, you know, making your own holiday dinner is really, can be a big thing. And that was where the roast kind of came in to people was, you know, hey, I got my vegetarian daughter coming home from college and she just turned vegetarian. What am I going to cook for them? I mean, that was happening over and over. And so,
and still does.
And still does. And people were just like, well, I could make lasagna or I could give them a salad. You know, the options before tofurkey were just, and I love salad, but it isn't like, here's this special day and here's this special food. And I love vegan lasagna as well, but it isn't like Thanksgiving sort of related. So having that connection to the holiday was really something that really helped the brand grow, and all of the attention and all the laughs and everything, the jokes that we had associated with it. And we love to laugh. We're the otters of the universe, right?
Like, well, this tofurkey, you really put all your superpowers together when you created tofurkey, because Thanksgiving is really the most special vegetarian and vegan holiday. That's our day. And there are so many events around Thanksgiving where we come out, where we claim our right to have a special dinner that doesn't have a dead bird on the table. I mean, it's such a powerful day for so many people.
It is. It's the food holiday, you know, I mean, where everybody sits down with your family and you go, what's everybody eating? You know, you talk about food and why do you eat this? So it really gave a starting point for so many conversations and was a peacemaker too, because it was like, here you go. Do you want the turkey? Do you want the tofurkey? You have the choice. And it was really amazing. You know, the other thing that was great for us about tofurkey, and one of the reasons, the secondary reasons for developing it, was that with tempeh, we sold all year round, but when you got to November and December, the sales just kind of dropped off a cliff because a lot of the people that were eating, you know, the eating habits were disruptive thanks to Thanksgiving and Christmas and people going home and there was nothing to eat. And so they backslid into turkey or whatever, and they just stopped eating their tempeh. And then you'd get a big bounce in January when the New Year's resolution market kicked in. But it really helped in the early days to have this holiday bounce now and something to do along with making the tempeh. So I see that. But yeah, it's been great to be a part of a holiday. So that would be a tip for bootstrappers. There's plenty of other holidays out there. Find a food, you know, Easter's out there, the 4th of July's out there. So a lot of holidays, but being attached to a holiday with a product's a huge bonus.
Absolutely. But I think you also learned that you needed to diversify in order to keep the business going all year long.
Oh yeah, you know, here we first came out in 1995 with the tofurkey, and we sold 818 of them in the Northwest and in California. And we started getting, like, to the Today Show, was Hollywood was bringing, you know, Hollywood actresses were bringing them on the Tonight Show, and they were just, there was this buzz. And then the calendar turned to January 1, it all evaporated. Suddenly you were going back into your little smaller cottage self. So it was an amazing time for about 2 months, and we were having success in the stores, so we were meeting a whole different level of buyers and markets with this holiday product. And so we were just, after 3 years, we decided, hey, we need to capitalize on this, and we're knocking on the door now. We need to take our foot out of the door and walk through the door and have other products. And that's where the deli slices came in, and the sausage later on, and they were all hits. So it was very helpful.
You talked in the book about doing all these different jobs and ultimately firing yourself from doing all these jobs. And one of the jobs was being a bookkeeper, which you said you weren't very good at. But
nope.
You seem to be a numbers guy, because there are numbers throughout this book. And I'm asking myself, how do you remember numbers from back in the 80s?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I mean, I remember being surprised when I got my SAT numbers back in high school, because I had like 600 something in math and 500 something in English. And I was like, that doesn't sound right. But I enjoy numbers, but you know, the detail in the grand scheme of things, I'm a macroologist. I'm not a microologist. I'm more of a big picture guy than a small one. And bookkeeping is a lot of, it's really a micro job. And it's a job that my wife, who is really good with details, was excellent at for many years as a bookkeeper in the Tofurkey organization. So as long as the numbers are big sales numbers, 128% growth, you know, wow, that's kind of cool. But when you talk about having to do all of these little reports for the taxes and everything,
okay.
Not for me.
I get it. I was still very impressed. I was thinking, are these numbers real? How do you know all these things?
Yeah, we've kept pretty good track of numbers, and I have kept track of every year's Tofurkey roast sales, because that was like a canary in the coal mine kind of question that we'd always get from the press. As Tofurkey grew, they'd be like, how many Tofurkeys are you going to sell this year? How many have you sold overall? So when we had the 1 millionth roast, we had a big contest and a celebration, and five, you know, and we're working on 6 million now. So
wow.
We're really still, but we know exactly how many roasts. I don't have that at the top of my head, but we know it's 5 million something at this point. So
very nice.
I like to track numbers.
Speaking of contests, you have a picture in the book that I can't stop looking at. How did this happen? Your travels with Tofurkey, where you have Carl Lampert free falling with a box of the Tofurkey roast.
Yeah.
How did he do that?
He's also, I want to point out, barefoot. He's skydiving barefoot with these dirty barefoot feet and holding a Tofurkey box. We didn't Photoshop that. You know, people ask if they Photoshopped it, but we had had this contest where we encouraged people to take Tofurkey traveling with them, or even if they weren't traveling, to just take a picture of the box in their house or in some unique fashion. And we had people send us like boxes that they took scuba diving with them under the sea. I don't know how they kept the box in recognizable shape when they did that, but they were jumping out of planes. They were taking them to the Taj Mahal. They were taking them to wow. the pyramids in Egypt, the Colosseum in Rome. We have quite a collection of Travels with Tofurky photos from all the great power spots in the world, and including people's homes and doing crazy stuff. So that was fun.
Well, I'm thinking that maybe one of the ingredients for your success has been this playfulness that you've incorporated into your business. You write about buying a box of costumes and allowing people to put on costumes whenever.
Yeah, this was before eBay. I got all these notices from factories, food factories that were going out of business, and they had used kettles and stuff to buy. And I was like, oh, this is cool. And then I got this notice for an auction for costumes, and it was a costume shop in Philadelphia that was going out of business. I was like, oh man, I love costumes. And so I bid on 10 lots of costumes. Wow. And then I won, and they sent them all out, and we had this big party, and I kept them in the office there for people. And we have the Hulk and Spider-Man, because I didn't know whether they'd be cheap kind of Walmart-ish costumes
sure.
or whether they would be theater quality, and they were theater quality.
Wow.
So I had all these robes and hats and amazing leprechaun suits. It was just really great.
Where are
me.
They now? What happened to those
I
costumes?
Have a bunch of them out in an outbuilding here that I still put on when I get sad. But I've given a lot of them away to the theater and to employees, because there was a lot of them, and they became a problem for the new
sure.
regime of Jamie's Tofurky, which we needed space for. So I gave a bunch away, but I still have some good ones. You need some? Let me know.
Well, coming from the theater business, costumes are a treasure, and finding the right one for the right scene sometimes is tricky, and some places charge a lot for renting their costumes. So,
oh yeah,
when I heard that you had this huge costume supply, what happened to it? I'm glad you gave some to theaters.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, where is Tofurky going now?
Tofurky's branching out right now. We just started a new brand called Mucho. That's Jamie's word. I think it's a good one for vegan cheese. So we are
Mucho. Beautiful.
Going into cheeses. We were supposed to announce this at the trade show in Anaheim, California in March, which didn't happen because of the virus. It was just as the virus is getting going. But we have I'm really happy with the R&D. We've been working on this cheese forever, 5-6 years easy. And I like where it's come out now. So that'll be coming out in September. And there's shreds, but there's also amazing cream cheeses. And we have under that brand, we have cheesecakes too, including New York style cheesecake. So we're branching out and just seeing that there's other markets that we can influence and sell in and use our Tofurky brand to push those products forward.
So where will we find them in September?
That's a good question. And I don't know the answer to that right now, but I do know on the website, there's a where to find our products section, and when those come out, it'll show which stores in New York will be carrying those and what products they'll have. So
that's very exciting because as you know, listening to people who often say, I can't go vegan, I can't give up my cheese. This is it.
Yeah.
And there are a few other companies out there that are doing it, but it more the merrier. We need to flood and take over.
What was the first cheese that you remember?
The first vegan cheese?
Yep.
I remember it was terrible.
Of course.
It was, I have to think about that. I know I tried soy-based cheeses, but they weren't very good. I can't remember whose it was.
I don't know if you ever heard the joke about Did you hear about the fire at the vegan cheese factory? Cheese still didn't melt. It was perfect the next day. That's what we used to say about cheeses. But then Daya came along and it changed all of that for everybody. Right. And now Miyoko is doing great things. So there's all these different brands, and different brands speak to different people and different audiences. So we don't see it, you know, as competition so much as just branching out. And
of course,
when you have vegan cheeses are a jet stream right now, they're just blossoming all over the world. And yet, in spite of all that growth, it's still less than 1% of all cheese. So to take it once again from 1% to 100%, wow, what a job. So we need all brands and all hands on deck right now.
Well, I mean, there are, I mean, I don't know how many cow, goat, and sheep cheeses there are in the world. There's a gazillion of them.
Exactly. I think two gazillion.
Gazillion, you're the numbers guy.
Yeah, that's right.
So are your cheeses nut-based, seed-based, coconut-based? What are they based? Are they tofurkey-based?
Well, they're different cheeses have different things. Not tofurkey-based, I can tell you that.
Or tempeh-based.
Right. But we have some, you know, cashew products that are coming out, and we have some tapioca. So, and just some other kind of ingredients that we've been working on combining and making them great to melt. And they're fabulous, really. I mean, the grilled cheese that you make with the cheddar is just amazing. So, good. But there's still a long way to go in cheddar, you know, in all cheeses, but cheddar, you know, what I loved when I was eating cow cheese was the white Vermont cheddar. That was extra sharp. Mm-hmm. And I don't see anybody making extra sharp out there.
Right.
It's when you see cheddars, it's always the mild cheddar, which I never bought when I was eating cow cheese. I always said, oh, I got to have sharp. So I'm a fan.
Fan as well. Yep.
And I just think there needs to be some more invention and innovation in that. And even in like the slices of cheese, I think could be better and than what they are. So there's room for improvement. But, you know, this is a relatively new. The first cheeses I remember seeing were in the late 80s, early 90s in stores. And I was just like, what? Cheese from nuts? This is crazy. But I think that, you know, can you give it a century or something before you bash it? I mean, cow cheese is like, what? I mean, thousands of years old, right? And I'm sure the first ones of those were,
exactly.
Well, I'll eat this, but
they're
not so good. So
I'm remembering Tofutti cream cheese was one of the first.
Yeah.
I used it a lot. I made a lot of cheesecakes with Tofutti cream cheese.
Oh, I know. I did too. And I still think it's a pretty good cheese. You know, it's not a whole food ingredient string,
exactly.
But it's very delicious.
And some of the original ones had hydrogenated oil in them. You know, I went for all the bad stuff just to get what I wanted.
I know. And I think that's okay, you know, and certainly in moderation, especially, you know, because you do have that sweet tooth way back in your memory bank for these products, and don't feel guilty. I mean, sure, go for it.
I agree. I loved reading your book. I love all the stories in them. You've got stories about not just about tempeh and tofurkey and building a business, but the friends and family that have supported you along the way, which makes a big difference.
Oh, yeah.
And your treehouse adventures. It's a whole nother. Yeah. Are you ever going to do that book? Because we need to read the treehouse story adventures, not just other treehouses, but your own treehouse adventure.
Yeah, I might do a book on that. You know, the treehouse that I built in 1984, it's still up in the tree. It's the land that it's on has changed owners two or three times. So it's like a yoga every time, trying to talk about like, hey, could we reinvent this? Could we fix it up? Because right now, it's like a luxury resort for the squirrels.
Aww.
And it hasn't really been kept up. But I did film a story for a book trailer. It right before COVID hit, I went up there in the treehouse and I cleaned it all up and I lugged up these camera guys and they interviewed me in the treehouse and they took photos of the treehouse. It's all at tofurky.com/book, but I want to fix it up and have it so that people can use it. And there's so many different ways. And there's a family there now that they want to teach. They have young children. They want to teach them to read up in the tree. So I would love to do that because they're magical. But, you know, Peter Nelson, this guy that did write treehouse books, there's some good treehouse books out there. And it's like an industry now. Mm. You can spend $300,000 building having somebody build you a treehouse. Wow. I mean, it's amazing. And I put like $2,000 or $3,000 into this.
Of course, so. You remember how much you put into that treehouse.
Yes, I do. You're right about numbers. But it was such a great thing. But to your point, too, so much of Tofurky happened due to the generosity and kindness of people that really helped out. Everything from the landlord of that piece of property that charged $25 for the four trees was generous. There was people that gave me free apartment to live in for years when they saw I was struggling. There was the school board in White Salmon itself that rented this school with 13,000 square feet and a commercial kitchen and a gymnasium for $150 a month. I mean, that's another benevolent universe.
Exactly.
Happening there. But I think that when you become an entrepreneur, there's a soft spot in people's heart for somebody out there doing the entrepreneur gig. And people want to support that and they want to help out because they see earnest people doing hard work for the good of mankind. And that always touches goodness in people's hearts. And I just am amazed at all of the great generosity that I've received and so grateful for, you know, what it is. People think of business as just this hard scrabble, mean sort of take all you can sort of thing, but that's not my story.
Well, I want to wrap up where either I read it from the book or maybe you could tell it to me by heart, but the mission of your company. Because you talk about goodness, and that's like the foundation that's run through your business for the decades that it's been around. You have it here on page 213 in your book, Follow the Mission.
Why don't you read it, and then I'll expand on it.
Okay, great.
That. Read some a short excerpt.
Okay, today this is our vision and mission. Vision, to help create a world where animals aren't used for food, and people are satiated, healthy, and content. Mission. To lead people toward plant-based foods by offering enticing alternatives to their current diets that make their transition seamless and enduring.
Yeah, that has really been the mission from day one. Although the mission evolves like the business evolves, you know, when it started out, it was really an environmental mission to eat lower on the food chain based on Frances Moore LePage's Diet for a Small Planet, groundbreaking book, where she talked about the inefficiency of animal protein. There was nobody back then talking about farm animal rights. It was all hidden Nope. from view. There was no YouTube videos. There was no exposés. There was no organization. PETA didn't start till 1980. So bit by bit, we added the animal rights piece to the mission. And then we actually also added the nutrition aspect to the business too, because again, in the 70s and 80s, there was nobody really talking about meta studies about how bad meat was for the body and how great these vegan vegetarian diets were. So the mission has evolved, but it's always been about veganism and about encouraging people to eat plant-based proteins and that you don't need animal protein in order to survive on this planet. In fact, if we are to survive on this planet, we need to get behind plant-based in a big way now. So it's exciting times. I've loved living this life and I've loved talking to you. So thank you for everything. You were a great interviewer and
thank you.
I hope you make some tempeh.
Oh, I will. Well, you're going to send me my kit.
I'm going to send you the kit. And you can post it to your listeners or whatever.
Absolutely. I can't wait. I like to say that it's to tune in love on this show. And this was an especially lovely one. Thank you, Seth Tibbett, for being.
Thank you,
Aaron, and for writing the search and for writing this great book, In Search of the Wild Tofurkey, How Business Misfit Pioneered Plant-Based Foods Before They Were Cool. I really loved it. And everyone should read it. Okay. Thanks for joining me. Have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
Okay.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Wow, that was a great interview with Seth Tibbett, the author of In Search of the Wild Tofurkey. This is a book, folks, I want you to read. Why? Because it'll make you feel good. And we need more of that now. We need reasons to feel good. We need to be inspired. And Seth's story is one that encourages creativity. It encourages following your beliefs, following your bliss, as Joseph Campbell would say. And with that, I'm going to bring on Gary DiMattei, my co-host. What did you think of that, Gary?
Do or do not. There is no try.
Yeah. So in the words of Joseph Campbell.
And Yoda.
Do or do not. There is no try. And Seth Tibbett is a doer.
Such a doer.
Yeah.
A good doobie, as we used to say.
The book was just, he kept getting knocked back, but got back up on his feet and kept going. Thought he was making the product that he was going to make for the rest of his life, and then changed it up really quickly and said, we need to make this.
Yeah.
And started making tofurkey. And just saying the name tofurkey.
It feels good.
It's so fun.
It's so fun.
Isn't it? I mean, before I became a vegan, I added it to a show that I wrote and performed 6 shows a week for 7 months. And I didn't even know it then, but the universe was telling me, tofurkey, tofurkey. And so tofurkey was a transition food for me when I was transitioning off the animal that you introduced me to way back when you made me my very first Thanksgiving dinner at your parents' house. You put thin slices of tofurkey on top of stuffing and mashed potatoes and gravy. And it's a comfort meal now for me.
You know, I think we might have to do that again sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I know our Thanksgivings the last decade or so, they've been all clean, whole foods. We don't get anything processed. But, you know, a little tofurkey, maybe the roast or the deli slices.
Yeah, just a little tiny bit.
That could be fun.
Yeah. And I really appreciate the book. I'm really glad that you have brought his interview to Responsible Eating and Living and shared it with our listeners, because it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And it's a story for not just vegans, but for anyone who is an entrepreneur or has the entrepreneurial spirit.
The bootstrappers, he calls them.
Right. I had another friend who called people like Seth. It takes a person that has sawdust and glitter to really make it in this life. And Seth has both sawdust and glitter.
Well, you know, he talks about the costumes that he picked up from some theater.
Right.
And he allowed people in the company to put them on whenever. He certainly did. And there was the glitter.
Right. There are people who have nothing but sawdust running through their veins. And there are people who have nothing but glitter running through their veins. And then there's people like Seth who have both running through their veins.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I learned that from someone a long time
ago. I'm glad you brought that up. The sawdust, that's making me think of the treehouse he lived in for a while.
Right. It's a sawdust and glitter story. You can quote me on that.
I will. I will quote you. What works for me are the lifelines, like Seth's book, the things that keep you uplifted, because it is very easy to go to the dark side right now.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the things that we do here at Responsible Eating and Living Pandemic Headquarters, obviously, is make delicious food. A friend just told us we were experts in eating.
Right. We are. I mean, if we are experts in anything, it's eating. Eating and changing toilet paper. We're experts at both of those things.
Thank you for that. And while we're moaning the lack of the ability to eat out, we eat outside, literally, on our terrace. And this past weekend, we made a phenomenal brunch. And there are people that comment from time to time when I post these meals that we make. And they say, oh my God, they're too much trouble. It's so hard. Well, what else are you doing during sheltering in place? I mean, I know a lot of people are busy, but
a lot of people are busy working and raising their families while enduring the pains and sufferings of life.
It's hard.
Yeah.
But for me, I relax while I'm cutting and chopping. And we were in the kitchen. We were preparing together. We were chatting together, mm-hmm. working together.
Crying together.
And then when we were all finished, we sat down to a lovely meal that we ate out on the terrace.
Our brunches are phenomenal. And this was unbelievably...
I think breakfast foods are my favorite.
Yeah. Well...
Until I'm craving a salad, but...
You have always had that dream to do a breakfast type venue where people just come in for breakfast.
Yes, all day.
All day,
breakfast
all night.
Breakfast all day, yeah. I like waffles and pancakes and tofu scrambles and home fried potatoes. Yeah, that works for me. And Ticino, which we're drinking right now. So I want to send some gratitude to the folks at Ticino for creating this wonderful caffeine-free coffee-like beverage. This is not a commercial. This is just truth. I don't get anything from promoting them.
for promoting anybody. We have gratitude for all the companies out there still slugging it out and trying to keep churning out their products, like Ticino, which is a great product.
And thank all of the people that work for these companies during this time.
I agree. The other thing that's really wonderful about Ticino is you can drink it just like you drink coffee. You could put it in a Mr. Coffee, or I'm not sure they make Keurig Ticinos yet.
God, I hope not.
It works in an electric coffee maker, and it stays nice on a little burner, a little coffee warmer. And, you know, you add your plant-based milks to it, whatever you like with your coffee. It's wonderful. And they have a variety of flavors.
And it's good on ice, too.
And iced. That's my point. It's great in this weather.
Oh, maybe we could make a Ticino ice cream.
Right.
Which would be like a coffee ice cream.
That would be really good.
Okay, I'm on it. Thank you.
Yeah. Or a Ticino. Yeah, the ice cream or a Ticino espresso. Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds good. Well, we're out of time. So we're wrapping up here. Thank you, Gary, for wrapping up with me for a little talk back.
Wrapping up.
Wrapping it up again. And remember, folks, we're at responsibleeatingandliving.com. You can reach out to us at info@realmeals.org. We are part of a nonprofit 501c3 organization, which means
we're broke.
We welcome donations at any time. Thank you again, and everybody
have a delicious week. We'll be right back.